The idea of a board game that requires parental involvement is antithetical to best practice in the board game industry. You won't find a publisher. I was like, thank you, because you just gave me my sales pitch. I'm going to take this to Kickstarter because this is the board game that the board game industry would never publish. And I can only do this with crowdfunding.
Hey, this is the Built in Seattle podcast. I'm Adam Schoenfeld. On this show, I chat with Seattle's best entrepreneurs, operators, and investors about how they think and how they operate. On this episode, I sat down with Dan Shapiro. Dan's a four-time company founder. He's the CEO at Glowforge and the creator of Robot Turtles, which is a board game that helps teach kids how to code. Dan has set multiple crowdfunding records, and we talk about that in this episode. He learned about crowdfunding by spending just $25 and having no real goal. And this is kind of how he operates, following his curiosity, taking a lot of shots, and looking for opportunities for what he calls contrarian segmentation. We got to hear how Dan made the leap from his first startup in carrier technology to SparkBuy, which was a comparison shopping company acquired by Google, and now all the way to selling a physical product at Glowforge. I've learned a lot from Dan. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm sitting here with the one, the only, Dan Shapiro.
Hey, Adam. Thanks for having me.
We're in Glowforge's amazing, is this considered Soto?
Yeah.
Soto office.
This is a more than a century old ice factory we're sitting in.
Wow. Fun fact.
Yeah. It used to be Zulily. And then a century before that, this was from the days when you had to make ice in factories because they didn't have machines in your home that could make stuff. And I love that because we're about to do that with a whole new range of stuff that you can make with Glowforge.
Wow, but that's crazy.
I'm getting ahead of things.
No, I love that. I love that. It's dangerously close to Krispy Kreme as well.
Yeah. And Macrina across the street. That's deadly. So,
if you are on a low-carb diet, this is a challenging spot to be.
I just have a strict no carbs during the workday policy. Bring stuff home, though. That's good.
Thank you for being here. I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. I was just trying to remember when we first met and who connected us. But
and likewise. I remember working together at Techstars more than a decade ago.
It's good to be talking to you, especially since you are a crowdfunding celebrity now, and back then you weren't.
That's true. Back then, I didn't know what I'm doing. I still don't, but people believe me less when I say that.
But
now.
Twice, you've set, what is it, it's two records in crowdfunding of some kind?
Yeah.
We'll talk about that, but I first wanted to just call you a crowdfunding celebrity, because do people call you that?
I think it's a first. I'll put that on my name tag from here on out.
Perfect. That'd be a good like Twitter bio from now on.
Yeah, yeah. My LinkedIn short version.
Exactly.
Crowdfunding celebrity.
It's perfect. Yep. But the question is, being a crowdfunding celebrity, you have a brother who's kind of famous.
Yeah, the real celebrity. So the famous Ari Shapiro is the host of All Things Considered on NPR.
So who has more internet followers, you or him?
Oh, he lapped me years ago.
Way more. Okay. Well, I think you have a good internet presence as well, but okay. He's got you on that one. Maybe a good place to start is just a quick overview of Glowforge, because I want to go behind the scenes, but also this is a unique thing, especially for those of us who just have been dealing in software. You deal in a thing here. So can you just explain it briefly?
Yeah, and it's poorly suited for radio because we're sitting here next to this thing, which is the size of, let's say, a bag you check. And it's white. It's got a glass surface. It looks really cool. It's designed for your home, and 80% of these are in homes. And what happens is you open the lid, and you put in a piece of material, and it can be leather, it can be wood, it can be acrylic, it can be chocolate, it can be stone, it can be metal. And then you close the lid, and you grab a file off your desktop, a PDF or a JPEG or a bitmap, you drop it into our web app, and then you drag it into place and you click a button. And it's only got one button. There's a big button there that glows and lights up when it's ready. And when you push it, it starts making beautiful things. And that can be anything like this pencil holder that I've got on my desk, which is, you know, cut with all these cool little details. You can see it's up on the, if you go to glowforge.com, it's one of the pictures there. But it's really simple. And that's something I designed in like half an hour, from a pattern that I found in a book up to that giant acrylic rocket ship on my wall, or stools and shelves that we've got outside, or picture frames, or this, let's see, this dice tower that one of our customers created, which I love.
Oh, what a sound it makes, too.
And that sound is cool in real life. It's not a radio trick because I've got 11-year-old twins, boy and a girl, and every time they roll dice, they go everywhere. So we started a family Dungeons & Dragons game, and they each have a customized dice roller, and that's what they use for their dice. And that was one where it was a free design one of our customers created. Download, click, and off you go. So it is transformative because it lets literally anybody at any level of creativity, at any level of technical skill, kindergartner to engineer, create amazing, real, beautiful products that you can use and share and gift and sell.
I love it. And I'd encourage people who are listening, other entrepreneurs, to look at how Dan describes his company and how you just talked about it, because you are very good with language and articulating what you do. I've always loved reading your stuff and kind of hearing how you describe things.
Thank you. It is only possible because I love our product so much. When I grew up, there was an ad that was all over the TV, and the pitchman was the head of the company, and the company was the Hair Club for Men.
And I remember
You know this? Yeah, right. And you'd see this picture of him bald in like the before and after, and he'd say, I'm Cy whatever, and I'm not just the president of the Hair Club for Men, I'm also a client. And that's me. I can't be involved with something that I do not love, and I've never loved any product more than this. It is something that is the culmination of like decades of loving to create things, loving to make things for people, loving to experiment for myself, and now not just getting to do that, but to give other people the superpower of being able to do that. It feels like my life's work.
Very cool. What a great feeling. I'd love to spend some time going back to talk about crowdfunding. And you've done this twice now, which is pretty unique. And I know you wrote about this in your book a bit, which I'd encourage people to pick up. But let's go back sort of and talk about, you know, Robot Turtles, which was your first crowdfunding one, and how that came about and how you decided to like jump into this thing of crowdfunding.
So for context, I'd spent half my time working at big companies. I worked at Microsoft and Google, half my time starting companies. I'd started a company that's now called PhotoBucket, and started a company that was called SparkBuy, got acquired by Google. And my twins were 4, and they were really excited about learning to play board games. And I would have rather stab myself in the eye with a spoon than had to play Candyland with them. So I was thinking about like, okay, well, what would be like a fun thing to do with my kids to teach them about the joy of board games? And at the same time, I was thinking about, wow, it's weird how programming languages are written for experts in the language, but they're not really created in a way that makes them easy to learn and onboard. And then I was thinking, what if you had a programming language that wasn't designed around ASCII text? And somehow, I was literally taking a shower, washing my hair, and this thought popped into my head. I was like, I'm going to make a board game. It teaches preschoolers who can't read yet the principles of programming by writing code with cards that don't have words on them. And then I'm the computer who's going to run the program. The parent is the computer who's going to run the program, because what I'm going to teach them isn't writing software or debugging. Like, all that will come in. But the key thing I want my kids to learn is that computers are there for them. And they should have the feeling of technology being there for them, not technology being a thing that they had to learn. When you start learning to write, and my kids are going through this a few years ago, it's just work and it feels like something forced on you by the world that you have to do. And then at some point later in your life, you're like, oh, writing's a tool that I can use. Some people never get there. Same thing with computers. Programming, learning software can be like a chore that you have to learn in order because somebody told you to or to do your job, or it can be like this tool that you can deploy against anything you want to do. And I didn't want to teach my kids coding so they could be programmers. I want to teach my kids coding so they could be restaurateurs or doctors or ballet dancers. To me, the important thing was the idea of coding as being the one in charge, not coding as being the bystander. And so the whole idea was, what's more fun for a 4-year-old than bossing around your parents? And what's programming except bossing around a computer? So I had this crazy idea. I built this game out of like inkjet printer and moving a little piece of paper around. Actually, one of the first play tests was Uncle Ari playing this with the kids. And I've got a picture of them like playing around with him. And it was really fun. And they really got it. So I went to a friend who is in the board game industry, and asked her what she thought about it. She said, yeah, nobody would ever publish this. I thought that was weird. And she said, the problem is the key thing parents want from a board game is to be left alone. And I was like, what? And she's like, yeah, core use case is awesome, kids. I'm going to go do something else. You entertain yourself. So the idea of a board game that requires parental involvement is antithetical to best practice in the board game industry. You won't find a publisher. I was like, thank you, because you just gave me my sales pitch. I'm going to take this to Kickstarter because this is the board game that the board game industry would never publish. And I can only do this with crowdfunding. And so in 2013, when I started cooking this up, 2014, when I launched it, it was a little weird to be making coding projects for preschoolers, mm-hmm. coding products for preschoolers. Now there's a fair number of them and they're great. But at the time it was kind of weird. And people's first reaction was like, why are you talking to preschoolers about coding? That's not right. And I looked at it like, I don't want screen time, but this is actually important skills, like trying things to see if they work. And if they don't work, just playing with it until it works, debugging things, like learning by doing something and watching the results. This notion of like, I'm going to give orders and then they're going to unfold. And on the one hand, I get the power of issuing orders. On the other hand, I feel the helplessness of watching them unfold the wrong way. And then I have to go back and do it again. Like, there's really fundamental things that are exciting and novel for a preschooler, but have, like, some people never learn throughout their lives. Mm-hmm. And so that was the crowdfunding campaign. Help me bring this thing into the world. I want it to exist. If you want it to exist, and if 1,000 people want this to exist, then it's going to exist. And if we don't, then it won't, right? If this is just me, then I'll just run around with my inkjet printouts and my kids and have fun.
How long from the epiphany in the shower until you did your first inkjet printout kind of play test?
Probably a month.
Okay.
No, not even that. Maybe a week or two. I still have it. It was literally a PowerPoint file, and all the original pieces were in PowerPoint, and they weren't turtles. They were robots.
Okay.
RobotRabbit.com was taken, and Robot Turtle was taken, which is why it became multiplayer. It became Robot Turtles, and the whole thing was an homage to Logo, which features a programmable turtle, which I learned in third grade on an Apple II. So turtles was definitely where that needed to end up. It just took me a while to get there.
Love it. Okay, so you went on crowdfunding and you said if 1,000 people support this, then we'll make the game. At that point, did you have any idea of how many people would, or expectations? And did you have any sort of commercial goals with this to turn it into a business? Or was it just like, hey, I need this for my kids. Other people might want this for their families and we'll see what happens.
I remember a friend saying, hey, Dan, do you have an angle on this? I was like, you know me really well, because for the first time, no. Generally, if I was working on something, playing with something, I'd be like, oh, maybe I can make something of this. Maybe it's a project. Maybe it's going to help me my job. Maybe, like, if I was going to do something like this, it was going to be because I had greater aspirations for it. This was like, nope, this just seems amazing. I was interested in crowdfunding because in 2014, it was kind of a novel, different thing. And like, people will give you money before you do the thing and not expect equity. That seems odd.
Right.
Like, maybe that's worth a try. I had a couple friends who'd done stuff with it. I met a guy named Max who launched what at the time was one of the biggest Kickstarters ever. He raised $12,000 because at the time that was huge for a game called Cards Against Humanity.
Oh yeah, know that game.
Yeah, and you know, took that to the stars. I was working with a dear friend of mine to help with Robot Turtles, who loved backing things on Kickstarter but had never done one. So he gave me a ton of help. His name's Alan Lee. And when Robot Turtles launched, I had the most backed board game in Kickstarter history. He came and did a game on Kickstarter. And when it launched, it was the most backed anything in Kickstarter history. His game was called Exploding Kittens.
Oh, yeah. We're a big Exploding Kittens house.
Yeah.
My 6-year-old loves it.
My one claim to fame on that was he was telling me how cool it was that the game was PG or G rated. And I was like, but Matt, our mutual friend who's a cartoonist who illustrates it, like, but Matt's famous for being R rated. You need to have a not safe for work edition, and you need to not give people the option of receiving it. It has to be just a like $20 for or $25 for the base thing, and then add $15 more for the not safe for work edition. And the not safe for work bundle outsold the one. And so that, you know, that was a lot of millions of dollars. That was my one little claim to fame was, oh, you should do the dirty cards too. That project was amazing. But in any case, no. My goal for it was to break even, and if I'd sold 1,000 units, then it would have cost me about $5,000 or $10,000. And it would have been my sort of summer break degree in Kickstarterology. Really cool. I'd just taken a leave of absence from Google after they bought my previous company and hadn't really done anything like that and wanted to do something fun and low key that involved my kids. And so my goal is to break even, which would have been 5,000 units, which would have been about $50,000, I think. And so I set the goal at 10K and 50K was my target. And it wound up being 400 some thousand dollars. It wasn't the most money raised for a Kickstarter. And I was looking midway through the campaign and I was like, this feels different from every other game on Kickstarter, but there's these games that cost $150 that are full of miniatures that raised $1 million or $2 million. So it's not, and Kickstarter ranked everything by dollars. I was like, so that's not true. And I was kind of staring at it. And I was like, I've got a lot of backers. I wonder if I have more backers than they do. And they didn't view by backers at the time. And so I went through and manually looked at all the top grossing board games to see how many backers they had. And then I called up. At this point, I'd met Luke, who runs the games team there, still does. Amazing guy. Curates that whole board games category. It's one of the great sources of gaming innovation in the world. And he really built it into what it is. And I called up Luke and I'm like, Luke, am I crazy? Or is this the most backed board game in Kickstarter history? And Luke is like, first, I think you're right. And second, I think it's really powerful to talk about backers instead of dollars. That seems a lot more true to who we are as Kickstarter. I really like that way of talking about it. And now you can go and see by backer, not just by dollars. And so that gave me my rallying cry, most backed board game in Kickstarter history for the end of the campaign, which got some news and got some press around that, which really sort of fed the flames that had already taken hold.
Very cool. That's incredible to think sort of how that came about. And I'm curious, though you didn't have an angle, how you approached that, like your mental framework and how you came into that must have been a lot different than these other businesses you'd started because you'd been an entrepreneur. Do you think there was something magical about how you approached it that ultimately led to what it was? Or like how should somebody think about that? Because it's almost impossible not to start a company without an ambition, right, to go out and take that risk. But yet here you did it without an angle and it became this successful thing.
It cost me $25. I'll tell you what I did. I'd never done anything like this before. My first company was software for wireless carriers. My second company was comparison shopping for consumer electronics. And I'm like, my goal was to learn about crowdfunding, not necessarily to succeed in it, although that's a great way of keeping score. And so I spent $25. And what I did was I went and backed 25 different projects for $1 each. And then I just became a student of Kickstarterology. And I started watching each one and watching what they did well and what they did poorly. And this is before go back 6 months to when I was just interested in crowdfunding and thinking, I at least want to understand it because I'm talking to startups all the time. And, you know, we're both doing things like helping out with Techstars. And I don't know if you did Founders Institute, but did some work with them. And I'm like, people are asking me about this and I don't know. So it's interesting. I'll learn. And by tracking, putting a dollar behind these and then following their mailing list and looking at what happened and being invested. I actually did more than that. I backed a bunch of them for, you know, real amounts to buy whatever it was they were doing. But I did for at least 20 of them just put in a dollar just to be on their list. And then I looked at what they did and I became a student of the art. And I watched as they were late, as they were delayed, as they were fraudulent, as they were delighted, as they got picked up by manufacturers, as they got picked up by distributors, and saw sort of the whole range of outcomes and sort of watched my own reaction when I was reading it. And, you know, watch somebody like go dark for like 5 months and then show up and be like, sorry, all the money's gone and get ripped to shreds and watch people get super defensive and start arguing with their backers. And that sounds obvious, but I was like making mental notes. I'm like, you know, it's free to apologize. Like somebody's upset. That process of trying to get in the head of the customer, if you will, of crowdfunding just informed entirely the way I did updates and the way I wrote the campaign and the way that I talked to customers people who talked to backers who backed it and talked to people all the way through that experience. It made me way more conservative about that. Robot Turtle shipped early by a couple of weeks, I think it was, you know, hit the holiday date that we said we were going to. Even then, there were a couple of special rewards that went out like 2 or 3 weeks late. And you can bet that I was on top of that, told people ahead of time, apologized profusely, threw in something extra, and really did everything I could to make that go through. And it helped that the whole thing was just fulfilled with such a profound sense of gratitude, because I got to do something amazing that I did not plan to do, that did not, I had no right to do, that like, not a board game designer.
I mean, it makes sense coming from Carrier Software and comparison shopping, right? Of course.
Yeah. I mean, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I think a lot about privilege. White guy, parents are professors, grew up an upper middle class household, got an engineering degree, learned how to make things, got, you know, my first job at Microsoft, paid well. And so there are all these things that people struggle their whole lives to do that I got to say, ooh, I'd like to write a book. Great. Hot seat, startup CEO guidebook. That's hotseatbook.com. Hot seat. So you'll publish this. And I got to do that. People struggle their whole lives to get a book published. And for me, it was, you know, air quotes, easy. And that's like privilege on top of privilege on top of privilege. And one of the things that to me was powerful going through the Robot Turtles experience was there's no reason that hundreds of thousands of people shouldn't be able to do this, but not everybody is able mm-hmm. to do this. Mm-hmm. And then when I started really getting into, I've always loved to make things with my hands and did woodworking for many years and the like, mm-hmm. and thinking making things is our birthright. For all of human existence, making things is our birthright. And it's only in the last couple hundred years that we're like, hey, you know what makes a lot more sense is people halfway around the world make it, and then you put it on boats and sail it over here, and then you put it in Amazon warehouses, and somebody shows up in a little van and drops it off in your front door in 12 right. hours. Like, that's the weird exception that technology has forced us into. But now we have a place where technology can bring us back, and where technology, whether it be crowdfunding, which helps you go fund and find your audience for a thing, mm-hmm. or whether it be a product like Glowforge that actually helps you bring that mm-hmm. idea to physical life and physical reality, technology is making it possible for us to make things for ourselves again. I mean,
it's incredible, like, swing of the pendulum right there.
Yeah. Right? I mean, like, imagine if nobody had kitchens and all we had was frozen takeout and it was a weird hobby when you cooked. That's what things are like with the stuff around us every day. Like, sewing your own clothes, making your own furniture mm-hmm. is a weird hobby that certain people invest like years to go do and refine. Now, that's something we should all be able to do.
What are some of the lessons that you think other entrepreneurs can take from the learnings with Robot Turtles and the success that it had? You know, getting funded and getting attention and amidst all these board games, right? It was pretty profound what you said about why people objected to it. And you're like, oh, well, that's the reason that it's going to succeed. That struck me as a lesson, right? A lot of times when you do the opposite, you can have a greater outcome. Were there other things that you think there can apply broadly in terms of how you approached it or what you learned in that process?
You know, the general form of what you just said, I call contrarian segmentation. And the idea is that if there's two things that you can do, most people will do the one that's most attractive. Sometimes it makes sense to do the one that's less attractive because you don't need everybody in the world. You just need enough people to care, to pay attention. Mm-hmm. So absolutely most, I'll take it for, take my friend at her word that most parents want board games that they don't have to be present for. But there are absolutely parents who are looking for quality non-screen time with their kids that's fun and educational. And I don't need most parents. I don't even need a million parents. I needed 1,000 parents. And there are absolutely 1,000. Turned out there was more than that. But it was way better being the, I don't think anybody wants to do coding for preschoolers. Well, maybe there's a few. Okay, so I'm the only one and everybody's coming to me. I don't know if everybody wants to have a game that they have to play with their children. Well, I'm it. Come and get it. And it's way better having something that's a little less desirable, but that you have all to yourself, mm-hmm. than being one of everybody scrapping for whatever the first place choice is.
Right. So being something great for a smaller number rather than a little bit for everybody.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's funny how the world works. Sometimes that little something great for a small number of people turns into something big.
Right.
Right. Like, I know the Y Combinator's sort of one of their mantras is like, you start small with some group of passionate people, mm-hmm. even if the area seems silly, like the classic example of, you know, renting an airbed.
Totally.
It's like, there's only a few people want to do it, but the people want to do it. You're the only game in town. They get really excited about it. And then you figure out how that can become bigger and bigger. And I ultimately didn't want to run a board game company. If I had, there were opportunities to go and leverage that. And, you know, there's some notion of like, there was interest in TV and doing TV shows around Robot Turtles and this and that. And fundamentally, like, I kind of caught you know, once in a lifetime idea with this. And it wasn't the thing where I wanted to dedicate my life to going in the same way that I do feel about Glowforge. I didn't feel about this. Like, I didn't feel like it was my joy in the world to bring more and more board games into the world. Although it's pretty cool. that wasn't my calling. But if that had been the case, in fact, if, going back to Max from Cards Against Humanity, I remember he said, Dan, why are you going to license this to ThinkFun? You could start a board game company. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that sounds awesome for you to do. That's not what I want to do. I look at a board game company and I'm like, that's Dunder Mifflin. You're shuffling paper. Right. Like, there's a little bit of like, what do you put on the paper? But a lot of a board game company is moving cardboard and boxes. And haha, joke's on you, Max, because he now spun off a shipping and logistics supply chain company called Black Box.
Oh, funny.
So if you want to actually like ship your stuff, you go to Max for your shipping and logistics. And so that wasn't the thing that got me passionate about scaling up with it. And that all goes back to like when you have the right tools, whether those be connections, whether those be that great idea, whether that be the laser on your desk that lets you print amazing things. When you have great tools, you can take something that would take somebody a lifetime of work to build a career around and build something small and wonderful with your own two hands to go do that. Your own two hands and one laser, whatever the case may be. Right. But with the right tools, you can bring that into the world. In the case of Robot Turtles, one of the key tools was really just the fearlessness of being able to pick up the phone and call a bunch of vendors and be like, hey, how would you make this? How much would it cost? And so on. So that by the time the board game funded, I knew exactly like, okay, I send the artwork here. By the way, all the artwork came from a contractor who I hired. Send the artwork here and ship it off and off you go.
Very cool. And it turned out that it led to the idea for Glowforge, right? Like the stories are actually tied together, which I find fascinating. But it's interesting how you talk about it as this one-time mission that you accomplished, right? And now, but it led you to what's maybe a much longer-term mission for you, that thing that you really do want to sink your teeth in for a long, long time. I don't know if you see it as lifelong, but...
Yeah, I think it could be. We'll see if the world agrees with me. And it was, in fact, prototype. What actually happened was a friend said, hey, my son wants to take the turtle and jam it in his pocket. You should make like a deluxe 3D edition that has like actual turtles you can shove in your pocket. And I said to him, hey, you work in fabrication at Boeing. Like, let's talk about how that could happen. And he walked me through all the different ways that you can make things. And that ruled them all out for a bunch of different reasons. And then at the end, he was like, oh, and of course, there's the laser cutter. And I was like, laser cutter? And he's like, oh, yeah, no. I mean, like, it sits in the back, and it's this, like, 1970s technology, but it's amazing because it's really fast and it's easy. And I was like, the turtles have lasers on their backs. I could make a special laser edition. And also, I actually helped put myself through college by building laser shows and selling them on the early internet.
Lasers are your thing, then.
So when I was, and my first job in high school was running the lasers and holograms lab at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. So I had this, I was like, lasers, you say? Let us talk. And then I went to a makerspace and I was like, hey, so I need to make turtles and I want to try 3D printing. I was going to use all the tools. And he's like, you don't want to 3D print. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, everybody comes here thinking they want to 3D print things. You don't want to 3D print things. It's like, what do I want to do then? He's like, you want to laser cut them. And I was like, okay, this is a surprising answer, but like, I'm going to just keep tugging on this. And I was like, but it's like, how come? And he's like, well, laser, the 3D printer is super slow, fails all the time. You can only make things that like you download from the internet because unless you know how to use fancy CAD stuff, you can't design stuff from scratch. And when you're done, it's all stringy and gross and everybody who does it wants a refund. So if you're not like, if you're not a 3D printer who's into 3D printing and just coming here to use it, then you should go use the laser instead. And I said, but it's $3 a minute. He's like, yeah, but it's only going to take you 3 minutes. The 3D printers are 50 cents an hour, but it's going to take you half an hour. And like, we'll get it right the first time for you on the laser. So let us cut a turtle for you on the laser. And I was like, all right. So we played around with that. And then I was leaving Google, or actually taking a leave of absence. And I had to fly down to the Bay Area and, you know, say goodbyes and hand my card and all that. And on the second to last day, I discovered they had a makerspace with a laser cutter. And the one at the makerspace I'd gone to, like, you didn't get to touch it. They had to operate it for you. And I was like, oh, this is it. So I found the guy who operated it. And there's this course that he ran once a month, like a safety training course. And I was like, hey, so about that safety training course. And so he's like, okay, I'll send you the slide deck. And all right, go ahead. Here's the combination. And so I finished up that day's work. The next day was the hand in your key card and leave. And I went in there at 6 p.m. and I left at 9 a.m. the next morning, not having slept, with a bag full of turtle parts. And I was like, this is awesome. Bleary-eyed, dropped off my key card, got on the flight home, and 2 months later had an $11,000 industrial carbon dioxide cutting laser imported from a factory in China installed in my garage. Because reasons. I was so excited about this thing, and it was a catastrophe. Didn't work at all. It took me days to get $11,000. Yep. It took me days to get the hardware working. It took me weeks to get the software working. And then I was at this magical place where I could take a design, which I spent hours and hours trying to get working and, you know, go through the tool chain and all this nonsense. But I could take the finished design once I'd done that and push a button and something beautiful would come out. And I started having entrepreneurs and friends come by and I'd be like, let's make something. We'd go out in the garage and make stuff. And they're like, what are you doing with this? I'm like, I don't know, but it's magic. And one thing led to another. And I thought everybody should have this magical glowing button that you push that makes your dreams come to life, not just me.
Can you just picture that scene now happening in people's homes when they have a Glowforge where they're like, people are like, what are you doing with this thing? And it's like, magic.
I don't have to because they stream it live on the internet now and I get to watch.
Yeah, just look at the Instagram hashtag and you'll see all the people and what they're creating. It's incredible.
If you go to Instagram, just search for hashtag Glowforge. You're not going to see this stuff from us, but you're going to see this stuff from real people out in the world who are creating everything from whole businesses around jewelry to one of my favorite was somebody tweeted, this is a pun, a robin who was stuck in a window well and they used their Glowforge to print a ladder, which they, two little baby robins.
Yes.
And they put the ladder in there and the little baby robins are hopping up the ladder and then the mama robin comes down and like airdrops a worm and then they hop the rest of the way up. Like, I couldn't make this up in my wildest dreams. I would never think something like this would happen from the product we created. But that's what happens when you get out of the way and you let people's imagination about how they want the world to be come to life.
Mm-hmm. Right. And giving them the tools that to do that, right? And I think you talked about privilege and having a lot of the tools and being able to control computers and like the skill you want to give to your kids. But you're letting others do that in a way that probably blows their mind because they've never been able to do that before.
I mean, that's why this feels like my life's work, is because it's not just getting to bring my ideas to life, but it's getting to do it in a way that lets anybody bring their ideas to life.
So, I mean, obviously carrier technology and online comparison shopping and games and laser cutting.
Direct through lines.
Just like, help me understand the common thread. Was it that carrier tech and online comparison shopping was just that wasn't you and you wanted to just be an entrepreneur and this is the real thing? Or how do we connect the dots on all that?
No, I have no right to do any of the things I've done. I'm thoroughly unqualified for every job I've ever held.
Do you always think that at the onset?
I mean, it's true.
Okay. But it's true for all of us, right? Like we're all kind of...
Yeah. One of my favorite parts about writing the book was I got to talk to Dr. Pauline Rose Clance, who's a psychologist who lives in Atlanta. And I called her up and I said, hey, I'm writing a book for O'Reilly. And she's like, Bill O'Reilly? I'm going to hang up on you. I'm like, no, O'Reilly Media, O'Reilly Publishing, different O'Reilly. And I wanted to write about this thing that you discovered, you named imposter syndrome. And she says, I didn't call it imposter syndrome. And I said, what do you mean? She says, it's imposter phenomenon. I said, I'm sorry. And she said, a syndrome is a collection of bad things that happens to you. Mm. And that's not what happens. What happens is people feel like they're faking it. They feel like they're unqualified. They feel like they're not able to do their job. And for some of them, it devastates them and shuts them down and causes them to self-sabotage. And for others, it makes them CEOs and it makes them rise to new heights and it makes them great. So it's a phenomenon. It's not a syndrome. And there's a chapter in the book about this, but I've met entrepreneurs who suffer from imposter phenomenon and I met braggarts and liars and I don't think I've met anybody else. There's probably happy, well-adjusted entrepreneurs out there somewhere. But I'll
let you know if I need any.
Right. I'm squarely in the I have no right to be doing what I'm doing, so I better work really hard to make it work anyway camp.
Yeah. And has that been important to kind of how you operate and how you show up day to day?
I mean, it's the only way that I could make it work if I'm coming in and saying, you know, please trust that I have something useful to say in leading a company to go build a $2,500 piece of hardware that's never existed before for a market that doesn't exist. Like, who's going to buy it? No clue. But trust me, what's it going to look like? We're going to figure that out. Trust me. You know, what's the feature set? It'll be great. Trust me. And at some point, you have to put together enough credibility, enough thoughtfulness, and enough answers. those aren't great ones, where people are like, all right, I'm gonna trust you on this. Let's try it and see what happens. And there were a lot of big leaps of faith. Nobody. So Joann Fabric has these in, I think, a dozen stores and has announced they're rolling them out in many more. They're an investor in the company now. And if somebody had said, hey, you know, Joann is going to be carrying this $2,500 plus, we have three models, $2,500, $4,000, $6,000. It's going to be carrying this thing and it's going to be selling materials and all that. And it's going to be doing that, like, you know, for everybody. I would have thought, wow, that's sort of the far reaches of what I would have thought would have happened. And there's no data that could have predicted that. There's no existing market. There's no demand. If you went and surveyed customers and were like, would you like a laser cutter? They'd be like, no.
They'd be like, what's that?
What do I need to cut with a laser? And if I was going to cut something, why wouldn't I use scissors or a saw? And then conversely, you show somebody a video of this and what it can make and how it can cut and engrave things with a beam of light. And they're like, that is amazing and would change my life. And so trying to bridge that gap, sometimes ignorance is an asset. If I'd come to this from the machine tools business, I'm not sure I could have made it work.
Yeah, ignorance. And obviously you're a curious person, the way you studied Kickstarter and crowdfunding. Was it that same kind of practice of analyzing all the details of the customer experience and what's broken with the current processor? How'd you get to be at least knowledgeable enough to be like, hey, I'm going to build a product here? And
yeah, and it was just being a super dork about it. It was like I was printing things at home all the time on my giant industrial behemoth. I was having people over all the time and watching them suffer with it, but then watching them be joyful when the results were done. It was me saying over and over again, so what would you do with this? Nothing. This is terrible. What are you talking about? Well, okay, but what about this? What about that? What about this other thing? Oh, okay, those things sound kind of cool. You know, going to makerspaces and noticing that all the people going up to the 3D printers were engineers who were excited about 3D printing, and all the people going up to the lasers were designers and entrepreneurs and creators who were excited about the thing that they were making, not about the process of making it. And, you know, watching and listening to sort of the visionaries talk about 3D printing in 2011 and 2012 as being like, you're going to be able to push a button and make anything. Looking at the reality, which is you're going to be able to push a button and make plastic spaghetti on a good day. And then going, yeah, but they're right. And the world should be like that. And how could this technology enable that? And then just spending a huge number of very late nights geeking out with my co-founder, who has deep hardware expertise, sold his last company for $112 million, also enterprise carrier software company, but before that had a hardware company, and who just built an enormous combination laser cutter, CNC milling machine, and plasma torch in his garage. And sitting there going like, what if we did this? What if we did that? What if we took this approach? What if we had the entire component list of an iPhone at our disposal? Because all those parts are cheap now since they're in mass production. How could those make a laser better? What could we do with a camera? What could we do with accelerometers? What could we do with microphones? And going through that process over and over again and iterating and trying to squeeze every last drop of value to make something that had almost nothing in common with the industrial technology that it was descended from, but was a beautiful device that you could use in your home.
Have you always broken down problems like that? And do you have a framework of how you break down these problems, or is it just natural for you? Like, this is what happens when I get obsessed or interested in something. I go that deep. I become the user. I listen. I observe. Or did you have you over time developed some framework or some mental model? That
no, it's the first one. It is. It is SparkBuy, a comparison shopping website, was born of me going to buy a Windows laptop, saying, how do I find a laptop that's less than 5 pounds, has Bluetooth, at least 4 gigs of RAM, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh, this doesn't work. Like, there's literally nothing on the internet. All the data's there, but it's not organized. And then paying a person I found on rentacoder.com who lived in Islamabad to go through a Google sheet every night for a week and take every item in Amazon's database and literally read through the specs, go to the web page, and type into the spreadsheet all the details about these.
Wow.
And at the end of that week, I paid him $50. And I think that's right, $50, $100. Anyway, at the end of that week, I went into the spreadsheet and I went filter, 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 sort. And even though I had spent a week trying to decide which laptop to buy, the one that came to the top was not one of the ones I looked at, was exactly what I wanted, was way better. And I was like, ooh. And so I was playing, and I was playing with that and a bunch of other ideas. Mind you, 98% of the ideas I play with are terrible and die on the vine. Like,
tell me one terrible one that you played with for a significant amount of time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, more than just one long night.
But. At the same time I was playing with that, I was playing with this idea of an all-or-nothing opt-in broadcast your life live on the internet.
Okay.
And that you throw a switch, and all your text messages, all your phone calls, all your cameras, everything are all live streamed to a central site where they could be remixed by the world at large. And I thought, that's amazing, and that's going to change the way the world thinks about existing in this space. And I desperately want it to not exist, and so no, I'm not going to go do that.
Okay.
But it took me a while to reach that.
It took you
a while.
How long did you spend on that?
This is my anti-startup. Yeah. This is my anti-life's work. Not only should I not work to have it happen,
this
I would
make
rather
the world
work worse. And even if it doesn't make the world worse, it would make my life worse. Like, I wouldn't be I don't want to be on the sending side. I don't want to be on the consuming side. I want nothing to do with that business whatsoever, okay. Even though I found it very intellectually interesting.
Is it important then to take a lot of shots? Is that how you make shots? And is that part of the philosophy?
That's it for me, yeah. The scatterbrain who has no right to be doing what he's doing and everything else. Then there's other folks who are just damn good at what they do and have been doing it all their lives. I remember talking to a friend of mine at Maveron, Jason, and I was talking about Zulily, who used to be in this building. Yeah. And I said, at the time you invested in them, there was like 100 Groupon knockoffs. How did you manage to pick the one that was going to be more successful than Groupon? And he's like, oh, that's just what the founders have been doing all their lives. Like, of course they were going to get it right. They spent the last 25, 30 years perfecting the set of skills that they need to win at this space. So that's a no-brainer. Like, it's a good business. There's no better person to pursue it. I'm so jealous. Like, those the entrepreneurs who are neither imposter syndrome nor arrogant, you know, on top of it. They're just the people who know what they're doing.
Right.
Has never been me.
They've been kind of mastering one craft or one motion or one skill set for 3-4 decades across the many companies.
I wonder what that's like.
So how many, you're saying you have had dozens, hundreds of ideas that you've spent time on before?
I would go another digit, like thousands.
Thousands.
Yes.
Okay. That you've spent more than one night on.
Oh yeah, maybe hundreds for more than one night.
Okay. That's a lot of shots. Yeah, I've heard like Seth Godin and others talk about like, well, I write a ton, but then I publish a very small percentage of what I write. Like it's about doing and trying. So you're definitely in that camp.
I remember in elementary school, a somewhat famous photographer who'd shot for National Geographic saying, I'm not much better at taking pictures than you are. I'm better at throwing away pictures than you are. Yeah. Yeah, lots of shots. That's about it. And eventually something comes through. And also, because I always get frustrated when entrepreneurs are like, well, it's because I tried so hard and because I took the right risk. No, it's because I've had privilege all my life and because I was given every opportunity. I get to take shots, and I'm not going to be bankrupt if the first thing goes sideways. And I had parents who encouraged me to do that. And when people talk about pattern matching and VCs are like, well, I pattern match against who I invest in. Hey, I'm a tall white guy and I pattern match against the, you know, CEO type. And that's wholly unfair. And there are a lot of other people who are no doubt better than I am and would do better than I am who don't get a chance because they don't pattern match against that. It's one of the reasons that I used to just, you know, any opportunity to go be a little involved with a lot of startups, I would do it and, you know, advice and this and that. Now I really focus a lot of my attention on startups where I think the founders wouldn't get as much attention otherwise, folks from underrepresented backgrounds, because I think that that's where the most opportunity is. That's that contrarian segmentation. Those are the people who don't get the attention who benefit most from the help that can be given.
Wow. Well, thank you for doing that for the community. That's awesome. And I can attest to that you do give back. Because when I met you like 10 years ago, I was starting a company that subsequently failed and I had no business doing that, of course. But you took a meeting with me and offered some helpful wisdom. So always nice. Well, look, I want to be mindful of your time. You probably need to make some more things around here. I don't know if this table is full enough. with stuff you made on your
yeah, we didn't get to the spinner or the puzzle or the wall hanging or any of the other stuff.
All right, I want to wrap up with the Supersonic Six and then the mic drop, the two corny things of this podcast.
All right, I'm ready.
All right. You can give long answers if you want, but I'll just proceed to the next question without much follow-up. First one is, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
I have always had to do most of my fundraising from the Valley, only as sort of an established entrepreneur was I able to fundraise here. And we just don't have a great ecosystem for investing in early stage entrepreneurs. And that goes double for folks who are traditionally underrepresented. We have a real shortage of financial support for first-time entrepreneurs, of angels who are willing to take risks in them, of early stage startup programs. And that needs to get better.
Okay. So more risk, particularly on first-time entrepreneurs.
Yes. Yeah. If you're coming in as an executive from a big company or a second-time entrepreneur, then Seattle's happy to fund you.
Sure. Okay. And number two, if you could go back to the beginning, would you still found your company in Seattle?
I managed to make it work. And if you can get through that hurdle of getting your first round of funding, then Seattle's fantastic. Okay. You can raise venture capital from the Valley from other reasons. So absolutely, but it is so hard. I spent, with every advantage that I had, I spent 9 months getting my first check. Like 9 months before the first check cleared the bank. And that was full-time fundraising CEO for my first company. So that was brutal. So yeah, I'd do it again, but I'm not sure I'd recommend it to anyone else because that could have easily gone the other way.
Number three, who's a Seattle company or founder that you're following or studying right now and why?
A year and change ago, I sat down for dinner with Glenn Kelman of Redfin and I said, here's this problem that I've got, which was sales not doing what I needed to. And he said, here's this solution that I used. So I'm not recommending it. I will just tell you it's what worked for me, which was I took a product person and I said, hey, your product is selling the company. Go treat marketing and sales like a product problem. He's like, and that was what turned Redfin around. And I was like, I usually never listen to Just So advice like that, but I know exactly the person and she's amazing. And I bet she can do exactly the same thing for us. And I followed that to the T, and that's how we've gotten the rocket ship growth that we've had over the past 7 quarters. We've been growing double digit percentages every single quarter for 7 quarters consecutively. And so, yeah, Glenn is a guy I look to a lot.
Fantastic. Yeah. Love Glenn. He's amazing. Learned a lot from him. Number four, what's a truth that you know or believe, but other people think is false or crazy?
Lasers are cool.
Some people are figuring that out now too.
Something a little more strategic. Oh, values and culture have a cost. It's a cost worth paying, but they have a cost. When people talk about their values or their culture, they talk about the upside of it. And they talk about how, for example, I'll take an example of another hardware startup that I was talking to that I won't name because this is unflattering. And they talked about how their people were willing to work night and day, that when the company was about to die and go bankrupt, nobody left. People all agreed to waive their paycheck and stuck with it through thick and thin. And I was like, that's amazing. And then I talked more and he talked about his war culture and he talked about how everything was war metaphors. Company was mostly dudes, mostly white, and they were bonded by this, like, we're all going to war together. And I was like, oh, okay. Yep. That's the rule, which is any wonderful piece of the culture has a shadow. And sometimes it's a great shadow. Like, you know, Google has lavish free food and benefits. And the shadow of that is a sense of entitlement where people will be like, I can't believe M&Ms ran out. I can't believe that right. The bacon wasn't crispy. Right. And okay, that's tolerable and you can make those changes. But culture isn't just a like, well, of course you're going to have a culture that makes everybody feel welcome. Okay, well, it can actually be a lot of work to make everybody feel welcome. And making everybody feel welcome sometimes makes people feel uncomfortable. Like when you say, hey, that thing you said, that was actually pretty exclusionary when you talked about the engineering team as a bunch of guys and everything else. And like, did you see the look on somebody's face and that fell when you said that? And she probably didn't feel very welcome. And by the way, maybe you don't feel that welcome now that I'm talking to you about this. And like, that's really hard. And it can be easier to not do that. But it's something you do even though it's hard, not something you do because it's easy and because it's free.
Okay. But something to think about as you're establishing those things, that there is this other side of it, which maybe doesn't always get thought of at the onset. Number five is, what do you know today that you wish you'd known when you started Glowforge?
There's a cliche around hardware being hard, and I knew about it. And academically, I knew about it. I will just tell you one story to fully grasp the magnitude of this, which is in May, I had to write a 7-digit check, the size of which defined how many units we get to sell in December.
Ooh.
And so I had to predict like sales 7 months out.
Oh, man.
And any extra money was going to sit in a warehouse and not be in our bank account, and any shortfall was going to be lost revenue. And holy smokes, it's not software. You can't just copy another version. Hardware, it's really hard.
Last question is, what ask do you have for this audience, or what can this community do to help you?
There's a team here at Glowforge, which are composed entirely of miracle workers. It's the growth team that I mentioned. And Marlo, our head of the growth team, has figured out in the past 7 quarters, so almost 2 years, how to connect with people at this passionate, wonderful human level, how to get them excited, and how to do that in a way that's thoughtful, that's scientific, that has room for creativity and has room for data science and learning. And if that's something that's exciting, shoot us a note. If you email your resume to jobs@glowforge.com, it will be in my inbox. I get all emails to that. And it'll get routed to the right person. And be sure to tell them where you heard about this, because we're hiring for all roles, engineering and people operations and manufacturing and supply chain. But if you say one role, I will say our growth team is magical, and somebody who wants to learn from and teach masters of different crafts would find no better place to work.
Awesome. So just jobs@glowforge.com.
Jobs@glowforge.com.
All right. Love that. I've learned a lot from you today. This has been amazing. Thank you. Where should people follow you or follow the company? Twitter, LinkedIn, what's your first go-to place?
Those are all good. I'm Dan Shapiro on Twitter, Dan Shapiro on LinkedIn. We're glowforge.com. You should go to glowforge.com and watch the video at the top. That'll give you the nickel on what we do. And then the big one is you should go to Instagram, type in #GlowForge and follow the hashtag, and you will just get this moment of creative delight in your day every day that will make you a happier person. It's incredible.
I can attest to that because I did it last night. All right, you want to drop the mic?
It is that time. Here we go.
Boom.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Dan.